Thanks for downloading this special bonus episode of the Outrider Podcast. This is a return to form, if you will, back to the old conversational format that I used to have in the first iteration of this podcast. Today's guest is Duncan Barlow. He is the author most recently of The City Awake from Stalking Horse Press, and is an old classmate of mine from Naropa University. And you'll pick that up pretty quick in the early part of the conversation. Some business before I let you get right to it. There will be one more episode with me and Steven on our topic that's been stretching on for the last 5 months about community and participation and resistance. And then we'll go into some additional special episodes with a couple other friends of mine. We're working on some projects that should be interesting. And in a few months, Stephen and I will pick a new topic and begin recording conversations about that. And of course, we'll be picking up some other bonus episodes with interviews and conversations along the way. So that's it. Like us or rate us in iTunes or on Stitcher, and you know, get in touch. Let me know what you think or don't. You know, as a friend of mine used to say, if you like this, tell your friends, and if you don't, keep that shit to yourself. So let's get to the conversation with Duncan. Thanks. This is the Outrider Podcast.
All right, so
yeah, so already hit record. It's been a good long while since, you know, we had a conversation. I don't know that we had what? Who was it? Whose class was it we met in? Was it
Bobby?
Bobby's?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bobby. Bobby Louise. It was my first fiction class.
Oh wow, really? I thought it was the summer class with Brian Evanson.
No. I was when I think you graduated
in 2001.
Right. So the summer that you're talking about, I was still writing poetry. And so I took all poetry.
So which were you? So what? Were you like a semester behind me?
I was a year behind. Yeah, a year.
Okay.
So yeah, I came in 2000 as a poet and then realized I didn't like poetry.
Yeah, that's kind of how it goes sometimes. Jen Zukowski went in as a poet, and everybody thought she was in the prose track.
Oh, really?
Because she took a lot of the prose classes. Yeah, she was, we called her the prose ninja.
Oh. Who was it that you used to run with, the girl with dark hair?
Holly.
Laura, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember. Yeah, I remember you guys were on it back then.
Well, I don't know about on it. We just kind of had our own little clique, you know, I guess. She was a quite a shy person.
Yeah.
And I don't know, what I always used to tell her was that I made her my friend because I could not compete against her as a writer. And there was stuff that she did that I wanted to figure out how to do. She's not doing a lot of writing now. She's trying to get back into it. She's in, she's been doing nursing. She's head of some nursing program and somewhere in Colorado. Weird stuff. But anyway, the record's on and we're talking inside baseball from old Naropa days. but that's okay. You know, I mean, people just have to go back and listen to the episode with Laura and stuff like that. So yeah, you're in South Dakota now, right? Or North Dakota.
South Dakota. Not a lot of difference where I live, except for maybe it's about 10 degrees warmer.
Right. How did you... Okay, so let's back up just a little bit here. I don't know. Do we want to go all the way back to the beginning? Because I kind of, you know, we had that class with Bobby, but we didn't really bump up against each other except in that class and then maybe at bars every now and then. So I know a little bit, but I don't know a lot. And, you know, that's kind of what this is about for me is you're in South Dakota, which is a bit more rural than where I am in Kansas.
Yeah. You're in Wichita.
Yeah.
I didn't know the city was so big.
Full metro area is a little bit over 600,000.
Yeah. It's big. It's, we're under 10.
So, then you would have graduated in 2002 from Naropa, right?
Is that right?
Or the
I graduated the spring of 2002.
Okay,
and then went right to DU.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
For the PhD program and.
Yeah, and it was through Brian Evanson actually.
Oh, cool.
He encouraged me to apply, and I did. I didn't really think I would get in, and then I got in, and I was not prepared.
Really?
Everybody there was so academic and really, really smart, and for every one book they read, I read like 10 to catch up. I always say I fell, you know, ass backwards into everything. Just sort of dumb luck on things. So, yeah.
Well, okay. So let's, what in your past kind of makes you feel that way? Cause I know that, you know, from before Naropa, you were, or you still are a musician.
Yeah.
So was MFA in writing something you stumbled back assward into, or was that something that had been part of that, that progress, part of that, journey?
Yeah, well, I think, when I did my undergrad in my hometown, Louisville, and when I got really excited about writing, but it was like poetry. I say it was like poetry because I think I wanted to write stories, but I just didn't know how to, as silly as that sounds. And so I graduated from there, and I was playing music, but I was also working in like graphic design. I was working at an ad agency. Oh, wow. And my official title there was art director, but I don't think I was directing much. My boss, who was a really amazing human, actually, he did most of the guidance, and he had the vision. But his wife passed away, and he kind of came to me after that, and he said, you know, I know you're pretty miserable working for all these big companies and doing this, you know, what do you really want to do? And I said, right. And so he actually paid for my applications.
Wow.
Gave me like some money to, to apply. So I did, and I got into Naropa, which I don't know why they took me. But I only applied to them because I knew somebody who went there once and went.
Who was that?
Bill Brown. Bill Brown. No. He was before you. He was a poet, and he went there, and I don't even know if he finished. He was like, he got in a car wreck when he was there, and it affected his health, so he moved back home.
So you were originally from Louisville, born and raised there, or
yep.
Did I get that pronounced right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I say Louisville, but the people back home would say Louisville.
So now that's not like Nashville or Memphis as far as, you know, music history goes, but is there a big, you know, because it's in that vicinity.
Yeah, I mean,
is there a big music scene down there?
We did for a while have a very, very big music scene. Like, I mean, the music is still there,
right?
But the crowd isn't. So when I was in the sort of heyday of it, you know, I was playing these massive shows of over 1,000 people.
Wow.
And the band I was in were like kind of like local celebrities, I guess, for what that was worth, which wasn't a lot. And now, I mean, there's a lot of good music that comes out of there. It's just, I love my hometown, but sometimes, and I fell victim of this. We just thought everything we did was better than everybody else. And it isn't until you kind of move away that you go, okay, I think that was just, we did that because we were isolated, you know, like right. We weren't New York or LA. And so we had to believe we were better so that we could sort of pump ourselves up to
right.
Get in a van and do it. So, yeah. There's a lot of music there.
So would we recognize any of the bands you were playing with during that time? Have any?
Not really. I mean, like, I think in the hardcore world of, like, you know, punk and hardcore, there may be, like, some people may know it. But we're kind of like, I think it ends up being like we were a lot of times we're maybe at best a band that bigger bands later like grew up listening to. So they would talk about us in interviews, uh-huh. But we're not like a legacy band, like Black Flag. Right. We were like, but like, you know, occasionally, like a band like Fall Out Boy will mention us in a tweet.
Oh, wow.
Or yeah. All so right. Yeah, we were like, right. Before, we were kind of, our band got popular in between the sort of the big 80s bands and then the 2000s bands. So,
right. Yeah, during the last gasp heyday of college radio then, right?
Yeah. yeah, I guess so. We did everything we could to not succeed, though. We weren't right.
So was that when you were an undergrad? What years were you an undergrad?
So I was on the six-year plan.
Right. I was on the five-year plan, so.
Yeah, I went in, failed out because I was more interested in playing music. Mm-hmm. Came back, slowly got into it, had a couple major changes. But yeah, so I was active, really active playing music from, I'd say, 87 through 2000, you know, with, I mean, I was playing music before that, but that was when it just kind of was like a lot of my identity, I guess.
Right.
And so part of the reason I moved away for grad school was to be able to grow up a little.
So when did you finish undergrad?
1996.
96.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're roughly the same age. I'm 46 now.
Yeah. Yeah. But I just turned 46.
Right on. Yeah. So we would have had the same, you know, rough time span. I miss college radio, man.
Yeah. You know, for a while, there was this cool thing called Burp Bladlock's Indie Rock Playlist, and you could just go and download 100 songs every month of like what essentially would have been on college radio.
Right.
But then the labels started coming after him for giving out songs. Mm-hmm. And so now they do it as a sort of a, I don't know, kind of streaming thing. But I discovered a lot of bands from there.
Yeah. All right. So it sounds like you kind of came to writing a little bit later. Had there always been something kind of going on at the same time? Were you writing lyrics for your band, or was that not kind of the thing you did?
Sometimes. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, I think sort of fondly now, it's amazing to think that it's been 17 years since you and I first crossed paths.
Right.
But like, I just remember you had organized, there were like these prose meetings, and you were so serious about it in a way that I wasn't yet. Like, I just like, it was Bobby, and I, well, actually it was Brian Evanson who, like, when I saw him, he came to some like panel I did with some people on technology, and he was like, afterwards he talked to me and he was really nice, and we were talking about bands and stuff, because he grew up punk. And so I went to see him read. So I was like, well, that guy was nice. I'll go see him read. And I saw him read Polygamy of Language. Uh-huh. And I was like, oh my God, this is exactly what I've needed to hear my whole life. Right. Like, like it was like dark and yet sort of innovative. And that was like when I caught the bug for full force of like, this is really what I want to do.
Was that your first summer then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I got in that class and I was just trying to fill pages. I didn't know what I was doing. And so like sitting there with you, and it was like you, Gavin Pate, Laura, Eric Olson, Matt Yoss.
Oh yeah. Matt. Yeah.
And, a woman, I don't remember her name. She always wrote a story about a girl with a Vespa, blonde hair. I can't remember her name, but Bobby was the one who was like, you know, kind of taught me the ropes of like the basics of fiction writing, which seems ridiculous to learn that in your 20s. But yeah, so I came to it late, and I played with language a little bit, but it was all very generic. Mm-hmm.
So who were your writers that you brought with you, packed in your suitcase, your books? Who were your guys?
That's a really good question. Very little, because my U-Haul was so small and I had so much music equipment. And I had to give away this really cool piano and all this stuff. But I kept all my Clive Barker books, because he was the first writer that I kind of got excited about, that wasn't long since dead. And I brought some books of poetry from some Kentucky authors. And I'm trying to think of what else I brought. Some Umberto Eco. I really didn't bring a lot because I just didn't have the room.
Right.
And so when I got to Naropa, it was kind of like start over.
Wow.
Collecting books. And,
right.
Which was a cool place because the authors were there, and then you'd get them signed, and you're like, you know, you're like hanging out with Lawrence Ferlinghetti, and you're like,
oh, I know.
Who does that?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, one of my favorite stories always to tell about Naropa, you know, and I always feel like such a, you know, a name-dropping douche around here because, you know, oh, yeah, I went to Naropa. And you're like, yeah. My favorite story is at a reading, I think it was my second summer, sitting in the back row with Jen and Andre Codrescu, and we were passing around a bottle of whiskey.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, okay, fine. You know, MFA program here in Wichita, you get your visiting writers in and you've got your four core faculty members, but really, do you get drunk with Andre Cordescu in the middle of the summer for no reason? No.
No. But you know, and it's funny because one of my students in my graduate fiction seminar, very talented writer, he's writing this kind of new, he's trying to create a new fantasy. It's kind of a new mythology. And it's really interesting. But he was one of Kredesky's students. And I just started laughing. I was like, ooh, there are some stories about that guy. And he's like, oh, I think we could swap. And I stayed clear of him. I was like, this guy might get me arrested somehow.
The student or Andre?
Andre. Right. The student is very well, you know, he's got his head on his shoulders.
Right.
Pretty well. But yeah, like my favorite story is sitting, oh God, it was Kristen Priveletti.
Okay.
Or whatever her name is. And she was doing a piece on oil. It was during the Gulf War. And I guess it was like Brian Evanson and Joanna Howard and Amiri Baraka sitting in the front row, and we were behind them. And this is like after I graduated from DU. And at the end, she's reading this poem, and she's in a bikini made from an American flag. And at the end, she picks up this oil can and pours it on herself, but it's clearly not oil, you know. And she's like making these faces. And
what was it?
I think it was like molasses.
And oh, okay.
Amiri Baraka turns over to Brian and goes, "Is that molasses? That can't be good for her. Molasses." It just like, you know, being able to sit there and kind of sit in this row with all of these different writers is like, that's, you know, when people are like, well, when they ask me about Naropa, I'm like, the good thing about Naropa is the summer writing program puts you in the thick of it.
Right.
You know, like you're there, you're working with writers, you're talking to them.
And as far as a visiting writer program, nobody else in the country is even close to bringing in that many writers.
No. I mean, I think there's like those, there are some that are like in the Hamptons and whatnot.
You mean stuff like Breadloaf or things like that?
Yeah, but it's not quite the same because Naropa has a certain reputation for bringing in both academics and just like those crazy people like
Thurston Moore.
Yeah. Or the people that just get like wasted and, you know, cause a scene.
So other than that moment you had with Brian Evanson, where he did the reading and you realized that was what you were missing, who else, you know, as far as the faculty had that impact on you, who was
at Naropa?
Yeah. Who dragged you, I guess, out of the whatever darkness you felt like you were in before, as far as, you know, you know, literary awareness.
Well, obviously, you know, and Bobby and Keith were there. So Keith Abbott had this sort of very, well, they both had a very practical kind of prose, right? Very sort of that dirty realism. And Bobby just always was a joy to hear talk.
Absolutely.
Just, she could just make anybody look foolish at any moment.
Was she your advisor or was it?
She was. Yeah. You know, it's all online and archived now, but I used to come over and sometimes, you know, she would just have you come over and hang out.
Really? I guess I must have been a huge douche because I was never one to hang out.
Yeah. I think she probably doesn't remember me now, but like, you know, she was very kind to me. And, I was there when she got all of her old, Super 8s converted to VHS. And so we're just sitting there and it's like, we're watching these like home videos, but it's like, you know, Ginsberg, John Cage, Charles Olson, they're all just like hanging out. And I'm just like sitting in Bobby's living room, just like watching these with her. And she's like, you know, telling me the stories, you know, like, Crayley, you know, and, obviously they were instrumental. And then honestly, I worked so hard. I was like working a full-time job at that time too.
Yeah, so
and so like, there were a lot of things I missed, but I'm trying to think of like readings that I really, really enjoyed there. I mean, I enjoyed meeting Samuel Delaney. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed, I always enjoyed talking to Eileen Miles. I remember Thomas Glave. I don't even know if he still publishes, but he was a young writer at the time that had a book on City Lights that was really beautiful. I remember his reading being very good.
Was that your second summer?
No, that would have probably been my first summer. I think the second summer, I took classes. I took one with, I can't remember his name. Yeah, I can't remember the name of the guy. Well, I took two with Brian. And then I took a class with Bobby because you kind of had to take one with Bobby. And then I took one with, I can't remember his name. He's the one that did the adaptation for Amistad.
Oh, Alex Pate.
Alex Pate, yeah.
Yeah, he was really instrumental for me. I mean, my first summer, Michael Ondaatje came and did a reading and did a panel with Robert Creeley and Robin Blazer. And that was my huge light bulb moment. I mean, before that, I'd been all, you know, Kerouac and Hemingway and, you know, Faulkner and, you know, the big American, you know, names. And then, because I did my undergrad in English creative writing. And I remember, I've told this story so many times, but I don't know that I've, anyway, I was sitting in an office as an undergrad with Jonathan Holden, who was a poet at K-State. And I was taking his poetry class, and he shared an office with Steve Heller, who now teaches out at Antioch in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And I'd taken a couple of fiction workshops with Heller before this. And so Holden was reading my poetry, and he goes, you know, oh, you do this very well and whatever, and you're very talented. And Steve Heller leans back in his chair and goes, now you just need to do that in your stories. And I went, how the fuck do you do that? And I couldn't figure out how to put these two things together.
Right.
And then Ondaatje gets up and reads, and I read The English Patient, and that was kind of the, you know, bonding moment for Laura and I. And that was the moment I realized, oh, that's how you do it.
And right.
I haven't quite perfected it. I mean, I thought I'd written the whole first novel, you know, trying to steal from Ondaatje. And one of the reviews said this was an update of Hemingway. I was like, well, fuck, you know.
It all comes. Well, you know, the reviews are hard, right? Like,
yeah.
I think there's this moment, right, where your book. Or whatever is, or whatever. That's very professional sounding. Say your book comes out, and you have a brief moment where you open the box and you think, "Yes,
right,
I have a book." And then you just—it's like shooting a bullet in the air. You're just waiting for it to hit you. You know,
right.
You're just like, "Oh God, the reviews." So I try not to read the reviews as much as I can. Maybe if I know it's a good review. But I never look on Goodreads. I just can't stand. I can't bear to have like what does the average human being that bought my book think about my book? You know,
right? Some of those can get pretty damn brutal. Laura Moriarty just got raked over the coals for her new book, and I was like, wow.
Oh man.
I am impressed. I am sorry that I missed your first book. I hope they put out a new one, because I should probably just go ahead and spend the $80 to get the used copies that are out there.
Oh no, don't, because there will be one for $5. It just depends how many people Google or how many people check on Amazon. It sets the algorithms off. Uh-huh. So if, like, let's say 5 people in one day look for it, my book suddenly costs $3,000.
Wow. Yeah.
And so,
I just try and find a copy on Abe Books or something like that. Cause yeah. I refuse.
If I had an extra, I have 2 copies. I have one that's mine, and then I have the one that I gave to my dad and wrote a letter in, you know. Yep. And when he died, now I have it as part of my memories of him. But there's a lot of errors in that that haunt me because of the how quickly it came out. They didn't edit it as well, and you know, I'm always thankful that she took the time to put out the book, and then it was a shame to see it go out of print so quickly, but she was just sort of burnt out with dealing with people and authors. And maybe one day it'll come out again, but it's very different. So every book I write is, I try to write it in a totally different kind of tone. And so that one, I was very much under the sway of sort of Kafka, although I would never say it sounds like Kafka.
Well, you know,
it's kind of impossible.
It reminded me of a couple of Laird Hunt's books, a little bit of The Impossibly and The Exquisite.
Oh, The City Awake?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because Laird was one of the early readers of that. Uh-huh. God bless him. He did not care much for it. He thought the original version, he was like, well, it doesn't sound like you. It sounds like Evanson. So I had to go back and kind of like, you know, it was a bad moment. My dad had died. My girlfriend had cheated on me and left me.
No.
And then, you know, a few months later when I'm like just not doing well mentally, you know, Laird gives me this critique, and it wasn't a bad critique, you know, because, you know, Laird is a very generous person. And so I just deleted all my writing. I was like, I'm done. I'm not a writer. I'm not just...
And
I'd posted, you know, I'd vague booked something, and Laird wrote, like, as a good friend might, a really firm letter to me, essentially, like, you know, where do you get off? You know, this is serious work, and, you know, you're not going to get it. And so I I ran some software and reclaimed all my writing and went back at it. And so, yeah, Laird is a friend, but yeah, I mean, like, he's a, you can't do a modern metaphysical noir anymore without it being either compared to Laird or Auster. And mm-hmm. if I'm remotely compared to any of them, it's either of them, it's an honor, or Evanson. I mean, those guys are all great.
Yeah. No.
Thank you. I mean, I really love those books.
Yeah, those two were my problem books with Laird, because I get into them and I think I should be understanding this. I like it, but I'm lost. And I think it's just because he's smarter than I am, and so it's one of those situations. I think Bobby used to talk about it a lot, is that, you know, don't completely give up on a book. You might not just be ready for it.
Yeah, she would say that. Leave it on your shelf.
Come back to it. That's why she had. Did you ever see her one woman show?
Yes.
Yeah, where she had the whole bit about reading Proust, right? About how she's always trying to read Proust, and I think that's her lifelong effort, is to find that mental space where she's ready to read Proust. I don't think she ever will be. But
I get that. Like, when I read Ray of the Star,
I love that one. Yeah.
Yeah. I just cursed Laird, because I was like, this book is it's still, like, probably in the last, I don't know, decade, my favorite book. It's just, it's perfect. I love it so much. But there's definitely writers that, like, yeah, that where you think, why am I not, like, the first time I read Age of Wire and String by Marcus, you know, I was like, I don't get this.
Yeah.
And yeah, I came back to it enough times that finally I think I got it.
Yep. Indiana, I got into right away. That's one of my favorites mm-hmm. by Laird. And then I really liked, what was it? Kind One. I really liked that one. And I liked Neverhome a lot. So, you know, I guess that's just kind of my thing. I'm more of the traditional type of lyrical thing rather than the metaphysical noir. So it's, I like it, you know. I liked your book and I liked The Exquisite, but I was just struggled with it, and I struggled with The Impossibly, and I need to go back and read them again. I feel like maybe I've gotten smarter, but that just might be the cats.
The cats do it. My cat is like pacing you.
I've managed to get mine to go to sleep. I never get to sit fully in my chair at my desk because my older cat has to be behind me, and the kitten is finally asleep for like the first time in a day,
but it's resting up for tonight,
right? Yeah. I'm gonna have to lock it out of the room again.
You know, it's The Impossibly I read, and there were definitely, when I first read it, parts I didn't get, but I was like, when I read, I'm like sort of a language reader. So like, if the line could almost make no sense, if it's well written, I like, you know, like it, if it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And then I think because I knew Laird well enough by the time The Impossibly was coming out that, you know, I kind of knew, I think, what he was doing there. And he was kind of like, I could tell he was reacting in a sort of way to what had happened in New York, 9/11, right? Like, and I think it bummed him out when people started throwing that into the reviews, because he didn't want that to be the thing. He didn't want it to be a 9/11 book.
But, right.
And yeah, and then I had just read Rings of Saturn, which, you know, he's constantly sort of touching on in that book.
Yeah. Yeah, it took me a while. It took me a couple of tries to get through Rings of Saturn. It was one of those things that another one of those things I struggled with. Bobby had once recommended the Alexandria Quartet to me, and I went out and I picked it up and struggled with the first chapter of Justine, and set it down for 6 months, and went back and restarted it and blew through all four books in about a month and a half.
Yeah.
You know, and it suddenly all this, and I've kind of been waiting for other books to do that for me. So I have a question about your productivity, because what is this City Awake is book number 3. So what's your ritual? What's your habit? You know, this was something we'd always talked to, Gavin and I had always had a big discussion about it, even in graduate school. And Laura Holly, when she was just writing short fiction, she was able to keep an entire short story in her head for a week or more.
Wow.
And just rework it. And then she would sit down on a Saturday, you know, for 8 hours and type it out. And that would be what she would hand it in to at a workshop. And everybody was like, what? You know, floored by it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm a clock puncher. I have to get up every morning and sit for at least an hour or so, even if nothing comes out.
Yeah. And it's interesting because for me, I have two modes of creation and they toggle between what's happening in my life. So if I'm going through some kind of emotional upheaval or depression, then I'm writing music. And if I'm stable and things are going pretty well, then I can write fiction. Mm-hmm. And I never wrote a lot of short fiction. So the last 3 years I've dedicated myself to writing short fiction. But the long fiction has taken a little bit of a backseat to that. So there's two books. So there's a book I finished, I guess it was after my dad died, and about a half a year after my dad died, I'd read a book about the loss of a loved one. Mm-hmm. And I thought, maybe I've never dealt with anything like what I've dealt with this year. So many sort of terrible things. Maybe if I just write. You know, and right. I'll never do anything with it. It'll just be because I'm not a very expressionistic writer. And so I just essentially wrote 3/4 of a book and then put it away. And a couple mm-hmm. years later or something, or a year later, I opened it and realized I should run with it. And I shopped that for about 3 years. And everybody kept telling me it was great, but it's not what we do, right? Like, which right. is great. I mean, it's better than just a flat rejection in some ways, but in another way, you're like, but what could I do? You know? So like, I mean, it was going to like, I was hearing from like really big editors at big presses and stuff right. and agents and everybody would say the same thing, but nobody would tell me exactly what it was. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to rest on it. And now I'm going through and just like, you know, giving it the Gordon Lish, you know, just attacking the sentences. But I'm actually going to send it to Anitra Budd, probably, who used to be the editor at Coffee House, and now she does freelance mm-hmm. and teaches and advises. And just sort of with the question of like, because I kind of think I know what's missing. Right. And just to give it to somebody that I can actually like trust, because I liked her work on a lot of things, and mm-hmm. just say, I'm in the forest with this one. I need somebody out there.
Right.
But so my ritual is like, it used to be that I would type during, I'd go to, this Quiznos in like Jacksonville, and I'd have lunch. I'd have this like small sub, half a bag of chips and some Diet Coke, and I'd write.
Yeah.
And that was my ritual, you know, and then wow. some days I'd create 5 pages there. Some days it would be, you know, a sentence uh-huh. where I just kept reworking the sentence. But for me, I learned something from Kafka, which was, you know, you just keep reworking it mm-hmm. and you just get it on the page. It doesn't have to be the most brilliant thing right away.
Right, right.
And yeah, of course yeah, that paralyzed him.
Yeah. The real creativity is always in the revision. It's not in the original imagining.
Right. The original you know? Imagining is like the sort of like when you get a house and it's got good bones.
Right.
I've got the bones. I've just got to really get in there and make this thing. And I can't speak. I'm not one of those people that's like, I'm a great writer. I'm more like I do what I can. Mm-hmm. I'm so horribly filled with self-doubt that, you know.
I feel you there.
Yeah, it's nearly crippling, and we live in a time where it's funneling down, where there's less opportunity to sort of quote unquote make it as a writer.
Yeah,
and I'm learning that unless you're publishing with somebody who has a really great publicist with connections,
yeah, it just kind of floats.
Yeah, Yeah. No, and they say there's 3 months. A book has 3 months to after it's published to live. Then yep. they consider it dead.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the only, and especially when it comes out as a paperback original, which
yeah.
is what The City Awake did. What's what my book came out as was a paperback original. But, you know, then they also argued that it has a bit of a, there's the upshot to that is that as a paperback, because those books that supposedly have a 3 month shelf life are usually the hardbacks by the big publishers. And they'll pull them after 90 days. And then a year later, they'll come out with a paperback and they'll get a second win. That might be when the book gets salvaged. Well, if you come out as a paperback original, because it's so much cheaper, yes, you have that 90 day window to get that first initial buzz, but then you can hang out.
Yeah.
After that, because bookstores are willing to keep a $16 paperback on the shelf longer than a $30 hardback.
Hardback, right. And it takes up less space. Yep. I mean, there's a lot of...
I used to work as a bookstore inventory manager. So,
You know the
right. The habits of the bookstore. You keep the paperbacks on hand because that's your steady sellers. You know, those kids that are...
Yeah, nobody... I mean, I don't know how many times I walk into a bookstore. Well, not anymore. There's not really any here, but I would walk into a bookstore and think, I really want this book, but it's $30, you know? And I'd sort of like hem and haw. Luckily, when I was living in Florida, there's one of the greatest used bookstores I've ever been to. It's like a Rose Red situation where they just keep building onto the building. I would go in there. My friend was like, oh, let's go look at this bookstore. And when I first moved there, and I was like, yeah, what are they going to have? I lived in Denver, you know, cocky.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, first edition of this, first edition of this, first edition of this. And I took whenever I would take somebody there, Brian Evanson would leave with bags of books. He was like, how does this place exist? You know? And it's like,
yeah.
So there's a heaven for our books in somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah, my problem has always been speed. I walked out of Naropa in 2001 with an early draft of The Evolution of Shadows, and while trying to get that one sold, I wrote another book and had that waiting around and had tinkered around with a few others, but had the unfortunate experience of my editor telling me, this is not a good follow-up, and there's some problems with this, and I don't think you want to put this out in the world, so just put this in the shelf and go write something else. And I was like, I'll show you. And I wasted 8 months after Shadows came out trying to revise this novel that he had said was, you know, just simply not good enough. And I got about three-fourths of the way through the revision, and I hit a spot and I went, oh, yeah. Right there. Yeah.
I get it.
I get it now. That's why it's not going to work. And I understood, right? So I put that away and I sat down and I wrote another book, and I've been trying to sell that one and not having any luck with it. And in the time that I've been doing that, I finished a third one. So I've got two floating around on the hard drive that, you know, are done. They've been through, you know, my process. I don't know how long it's going to take.
I'm the same way. And it's funny because I remember there was a moment where I was like joking with Laird. I was like, well, how many books are you going to have come out on each other? You know? And he was like, well, you know, he's like, I've, you know, Indiana and The Exquisite, he was writing at the same time.
Right.
You know, or maybe it was, and The Impossibly, but he was always working like many of us do. We're pivoting between a couple things. We have a couple things in shoe boxes. And we're not like, so Evanson's process is like, even if he has people over, you'll be sitting there and he'll go, I'll be back in a half an hour. And he'll go upstairs to his office and write for 30 minutes. Like, you know, he's got that, that like Mormon training that he writes regularly on a schedule. That's why he produced so much.
Yeah.
Where, I don't have that regularity. I'm sort of like, I should probably write something, and I'm like, or I could stare at the wall and just veg out because I'm so tired.
Well, you know, to be honest with you, you know, that's that's still work for a writer. You've got to you've got to let that brain shut down at some point and just process everything.
Well, thank you for that. That's going to be – I'm going to be like – not tonight. I'm writing.
Were you not paying attention to the Buddhism at Naropa to just be still and quiet?
I tried to drown them out of my brain. What are you guys banging on pots and pans for? I'm trying to write. No, I think – I mean, that's what I say in the summer. I was like, you know, in the summer, it's like – where I'm like, you know, I start every summer the same way. This is the summer that all I do is write.
Right.
And then, you know, I close my eyes and I wake up and I'm like, oh God, my syllabus is due in a day. You know, the summer's over. And I always say it's kind of like my mind regaining. It's sort of like refertilizing, right? Mm-hmm. Like kind of like getting nutrients back. And then as soon as I'm like tends to be, as soon as things get crazy at school where I'm like, I've got 40 things to grade and two dissertations to sit on and, you know, committees and, you know, I'm working on South Dakota Review. I'm like, I've got the ideas and I get back into writing.
Right.
And there I go. And so I've been working on a historical novel for the like last 2 years, mm-hmm. 3 years maybe, just pecking away at it. And I don't know, you know, like it's like it was one of those things like I've never done this.
Right.
I'm going to do this. And I'm working on a memoir. And I was like, oh, well, I don't like memoirs. So let me try to write one. So, yeah, I hear you. We're always working on something. It's always something. And I would like to think that at some point for people like us, we'll get a following of some kind. And then, you know, those old manuscripts, somebody will be like, you got anything? And you're like, oh, well, blow the dust off this, push it up again, you know? And get it out there in the world.
Maybe someday I'll be old enough and wise enough to fix the problem with that that unfixable novel. Who knows?
Right. You're like clown on roller skates. There was the problem. Right. Get rid of the clown.
There you go. Now, I'm going to backtrack a little bit because I'm curious. What year was it that your father died?
I guess 2012. Yeah, 2012.
Really? Wow. Yeah. Mine passed in 2010.
Oof.
You know, and it was rough. And I've been trying to write about it. Have you ever wanted or thought about writing about your dad, or is that not something?
That's what I did. That's I'm looking at the manuscript right now. It's the one I was talking about. And it toggles between this like first person narrative of the sitting in the hospital room, watching him, you know, going through the process.
Right.
And then the other storyline is like coming back home after he's passed and engaging in this relationship with this old longtime friend. And, and it, the thing that's interesting is in right now doing the revisions, that's the hard part because at the time I was kind of in numb and just writing forward.
Right.
And now it's like, it's being back in that hospital room and smelling that air and hearing those sounds again. That's just like, it's a really hard thing to revise. And then I realized like, shit, now I'm going to have to do readings of this when it comes out.
Right. You know? Right.
So yeah. What was your, what's been your experience?
Well my dad and I had a really rocky relationship, which I think is making it harder. Did you and your dad get along? Did you have a...
Well, we did. Like, so around when I was 19, he had a heart attack and he quit drinking.
Right.
And what are you doing, Kat? sorry, she's... I don't know if your cats do this where they just sort of sit up on something and then they're just like, I'm going to scratch the wall arbitrarily for an hour.
Yeah.
So yeah, like once he had his heart attack and he stopped drinking, we started talking. And from that time on, I guess that was like 92, we became like best friends, which I'm very grateful for.
Yeah. No, that's good. So, that's good. That probably
it's hard to say which one's nicer, you know, like being super close or like because my mother and I weren't close, and she died in 95.
Oh, my.
And that was a whole different kind of thing to unpack.
Right, right. She had to have been young then, fairly young.
Fairly young. She was, she didn't look it. She was a alcoholic.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so she drank herself down into smoker. So hers was, it seemed quick. I didn't talk to her for a while. And then next time I saw her was in the hospital, sort of like slowly going. So that's like hospitals particularly.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know the feeling. It's been hard to write about my dad, mostly because there's, even now, 7 years later, there's still these moments where, I sit down and I think about him and that relationship and everything that went on, and have these flare-ups. It's sometimes hard to be empathetic. And the hard thing is that it's like my dad was not an alcoholic. He wasn't physically abusive. Mm-hmm. But there was just something in his personality and in mine. Maybe it's a mismatched form of narcissism and selfishness and self-absorption that we just could not, after a certain point in, I think probably my freshman year of high school, could not get through a conversation without anger and rage at each other and frustration and arguing about something, And I think a lot of times what it boiled down to is that, fathers and sons have a lot of expectations of each other that they don't quite know how to articulate, and they can't meet, and they don't know how to square that miscommunication. Yes. And so it's been a challenge to try and write about that. When he passed, I told his second wife and the minister, because when I was growing up, my dad said he was an agnostic, and then he divorced my mother, who was a preacher's kid, and married a fundamentalist Christian and started going to church all the time. And so I told his pastor and his second wife, said, I will be speaking at my dad's funeral, at the memorial service. I'll be delivering a eulogy, because I am the older son. I have a half brother who's 30 years younger than I am. So that's not
wow.
Yeah. So, and the first thing when I told my mother that I was going to do that, she was like, "Oh my God, this is going to be a shit show." he's going to get up and just unload.
And, yeah, which would be really bad.
Yeah. And I didn't. I was very fair and diplomatic and honest about the whole thing. But I still managed somehow to alienate my stepmother. And she decided that I was never going to see my half-brother ever again because she didn't want him infected with my sickness.
Oh, wow. So she's the real deal, Jesus.
Right. Thing. Right. Right. So I've been wanting to write this story about my dad, which will be the middle book of a trilogy. The first one about my grandfather, that's the one I'm trying to sell now. And then this one, and then a third one, which, I guess ostensibly would be about me and the other offspring, playing a lot with Joseph Campbell's, hero's journey, the core mythology. And the hardest one to do is this middle one. Yeah, about my dad. So I was curious how that experience went for you writing about your dad.
It's interesting because in reading it, the big thing, and I think this is for a lot of people who lose a loved one, is I kept saying I could have been a better son, Mm-hmm. And I mean, my father and I, we talked sometimes three times a day, just joking,
Right.
I would listen to him vent about things. He would, we really did have a friendship, but at the same time, I know he wanted me to come back home.
Right, right.
But I never could. And I knew, the whole time I was like, I've always put, ever since being at DU, I've put the writing and the job first. Mm-hmm. I've lost relationships,
Yeah.
I've I missed out on a good many things in life. But I always knew at some point I am going to have to, like, you know, come to terms with this when my dad goes, you know. Right. And so there was that sort of thing that I would wrestle with of, you know, maybe I could have done more. Maybe I could have been better. Maybe I could have done this or that.
Yeah. Yeah, I know that feeling, man.
And did you happen to see that Tim Burton Big Fish movie?
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. That's one of my favorites. Did you read the book?
I didn't.
Oh, my God. The book. Read the book, too.
Okay.
I love that story. The book and the movie. It's another one of those situations where, you know, I understand why some people like the movie or the book better for one reason or another. I get it. I know why there's a difference and you can make the whole thing, but I love it when, like with Ondaatje's The English Patient, I know people that, oh, I love the book, I hate the movie. And I'm like going, they're different things, but they're the same thing and I like them both. And right. Big Fish is one of those things where if you ask me which one I like better, the book or the movie, I'm like, I can't decide. I can't decide. I love them both. And oh yeah, it's like Field of Dreams for me, Big Fish, because it's all about a writer and storytelling and fathers and sons. And I'm a fucking mess at the end of that movie, man.
And this is long before my father died, but I was like, and I was not the only one who experienced this phenomenon. Like after the movie ended, it was like women were getting up and leaving and men were sitting there either quietly or sobbing.
Right.
And everybody, you know, a bunch of people, not everybody that I talked to, had a very similar experience where it was just like the men were sitting there and the women were like, well, I'm going to go to the bathroom while you work this out. You know, but it really does. And I should read the book because it really did capture that generational disconnect of it, the masculinity, the sort of like, you know, a lot of times it's the son who's the dreamer and the father who's the pragmatist and this and that.
Right.
But I was close to my dad, and it's still just, you know, like I think about all the years I lost as a kid just being like resenting him for
right.
this or that, you know. And there were times where I would like – I remember one time I was taking a bus back from Naropa after a class, and I saw these kids horse playing around, and they had like – one of them had these nice new shoes, and I just called my dad up. I was like, hey, Dad, thanks for all the shoes. I know you probably would have rather spent that money on yourself, but
right.
Thanks for the shoes.
Hold on just a second. Hold on. I'm going to grab something. I need to come back, but I want to show this to you. Hold on. I recommended this book to another writer friend of mine whose father died several years ago. Well, actually, he died when he was quite young. And I found this in the bookstore about 3 weeks ago and hadn't been planning on spending the money, right? But I saw the cover and I read the blurb and was almost in tears just from the blurb. It's called An Odyssey, A Father, A Son, and an Epic. It's by Daniel Mendelsohn.
Mendelsohn, yeah.
And it's his kind of memoir recounting of the time that his engineer father audited the class that Daniel taught about the Odyssey, and their relationship and the trips they then went on relating to that book and how it, you know, changed and adapted and affected their relationship. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. You know, my friend Steven's already read it, but just in case.
I'm marking it right now.
An Odyssey.
I have a friend whose father has started taking her yoga classes.
Oh yeah.
You know, and I think it's a similar moment where, you know, he gets to see her in this element that
right.
that changes their dynamic. And mm-hmm. and my father, you know, he read my book. He didn't get it, right? The first book. My sister didn't get it.
Right.
You know, she actively, actually, I was playing a reunion show or something, and my book was on the little merchandise table, and she was standing there, sort of drunkenly telling people not to buy my book because it was garbage.
Oh my God. That's what family's for, right?
Yeah. And she was just pissed off because she's like, didn't Stephen King teach you anything? And I was like, yes, he told me, taught me what I didn't want to write.
Right.
And, and she's like, well, who am I? You know, she's like, I've read the Scarlet Letter 5 times and I still can't figure out where the Scarlet Letter is in the book. And I was just like, oh, that's the sweetest, saddest thing I've ever heard. She probably won't make it this far into the interview, so I think I'm safe.
Oh, well, that's all
right. But she supports me. She's very sweet. She just, that was the funny. But like, yeah, the men and our fathers. It's
it's an interesting topic, and you know, with a lot of the stuff that's going on now socially, I think there's a real interesting social opportunity, for us writers in particular. To kind of drive the conversation about, you know, manhood and masculinity and in relation to, you know, the broader society, the expanding of rights and access for women and the LGBT community and what that means to how we have to change.
Yeah.
Right. And I think books like the one that sounds like the one that you're working on, Mendelsohn's book, you know, maybe what I'm working on, I don't know, is a chance to repair that damage that patriarchy's kind of done to men.
Yeah.
And which
it is a moment, whether or not it's a moment we observe, the sleeper is awoken right in the background there. Oh. Little one.
Yeah.
Whether or not we learn, I feel like men have had a lot of moments to learn.
And they haven't.
And they never do.
But, yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
it's a unique opportunity. It's wildly different now than I think it was, say, in the early 90s when Sam Keen came out with Fire in the Belly, which I thought was the best of the men's movement's books of the early 90s. You know, that one, people kind of ignored that one, but they paid more attention to Iron John, which was all the fairy tales. And all that led to was, you know, guys running around naked in the woods, dancing around a 50-foot wooden penis, banging on drums. And that's not manhood.
I love that so much. that happened?
Yes. Oh, my God. Right. So. Or it led to the Promise Keepers, which was just, you know, a fancy, you know, return to traditional, you know, masculine gender roles.
Yeah, yeah.
But now we actually we're in a situation now where I think more and more women are standing up and going like, this is not right. This is not appropriate. We've got, you know, we got this fuckwit in the White House that, you know, can brag about grabbing women by the pussy and become president. And
right.
It's become intolerable.
It has become. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just become intolerable is a good word. You know, I'm trying to think of like, I just, you know, I can't even, there's not enough words.
Right.
You know, I just come back to the review of Shark Sandwich by Spinal Tap, Shit Sandwich. That's
brings me to my last question that I always like to ask when I was doing these conversations more on the regular, but I will still like to ask it, particularly of my fellow Neuropites where conversation about community building was always such an important thing. Is it something that we always had? So as a writer, and this I think would be particularly interesting considering your location in North Dakota, where you don't have an indie bookstore around, do you? Or nearby?
No, we don't. No, there's kind of one in Sioux Falls, which is about an hour south or north of us.
So basically in your town, would you have like a Hastings?
Oh, no, no.
Not even that?
We don't have a Taco Bell. Are you kidding? Have a Barnes & Noble at the university, but I mean, they carry a handful of books that are not on the reading lists, but we don't. I mean, we depend upon the unfortunate. We have the unfortunate dependence upon Amazon.
Right. So, in that environment, as writers, because we could talk about, you know, Wichita and my problems, but that would take another, you know, half an hour at least. But in that situation where there can't be much of a literary community there outside of the university, and it kind of is a demand upon us as writers to be ambassadors for the literary mind, the literary life, for an interest in reading. So it's I'm always interested in what people think, what other writers think we should be doing as writers, aside from, you know, continuing to write good stories. What should we be doing to engage the community to restock the pool of readers? What should we, how should we engage the world at large to ensure that, you know, we have a future?
A future. No, this is a fantastic question, because usually when we talk about community, we are talking about a community of writers. I mean, the micro press world exists on the fact that other writers buy writers' books.
Right.
You know, I think in some regards, I think teaching, you know, has built that into my life, where I get to meet a lot of people. Hate teaching the early introduction to creative writing classes because it's heavy lifting, but I quite like it when I get, and I teach them regularly, because they're, you know, these are the moments where you light the fire, right? And we always talk about converting, you know. I have students, grad students, who are like, I converted someone to a creative writing major. And I go, oh, great. I always joke around. I always say, like, yeah, I ruined somebody's life today.
Right.
I just switched from med to creative writing.
You went from a chance to paying back your student loans to never paying back your student loans.
Back. Right. Yeah. It's interesting, because I have these two worlds that sometimes cross over but don't necessarily in the way I would love for them to. So, like, there's all these people that knew my music. Mm-hmm. And then there's these people that know me as a writer. And I would love for the people that grew up liking my music to buy the books, to read the articles I'm posting on other writers and stuff like that. But, you know, social media is fake, right? It's like they can like it and move on, and they've done their civil duty. But it is a really good question. And I think sometimes, I don't think necessarily I'm always the best ambassador for it, because I don't see it, but I'm told my writing is quote unquote difficult. I don't try to make it that way. I just try to write stories and play with language in a way that I find appeals to me.
Right.
But I do, like, you know, we do at the university, we have these things where we do outreach, and you know, we have this writing camp where, you know, young students come and they get to write, and they get to take these like 2-hour classes with writers and interact with them. I think the problem sometimes with writing is that it gets so clicky.
Right.
And I don't know if you've ever been to an AWP, but when you go to the AWPs, it's very evident. It's like the flavor of the month walks around, people trail them, the rock stars come through, and it's like, this is the only moment that these people are sometimes important, right? The rest of the time they order their coffee and get treated the same way as the rest of us. But at this moment, this is the prom. This is where they are the king and queen, and they're and I've always been very sort of like indifferent to that. I think I want to know and be friendly to everybody.
Right.
And so I don't know. That's a really good, I'm sort of talking all around it, but I don't know. I mean, I think for me, using the music world has been helpful. I've actually talked to some friends' bands. We've never come to anything, but I always said, you know, if you want somebody like to just come on tour and I can sell merch, but like do a reading at your show, you know, like instead of a band, you know,
right.
Because I know that like Mars Volta did that with Saul Bellow, or not Saul Bellow. What's his name? Saul Williams? Who's the guy that started as the slam poet and he... Yeah.
Taylor Molly?
No. I can't remember his name. I recently saw him in person years later. I don't know. I can't remember his name. But that's not abnormal for me. I can't remember names, but so the Mars Volta had him. It was like there was a band that opened, and then he read, and then they played. But he was very pop culture based at the time. Like, so people kind of knew who he was because he had done all the Death Slam things. Right, right. He was like a big rock star from that world. And, but I mean, I think that would be great. I mean, if you could deal with being heckled, it would have to be a certain, you couldn't go with like Mastodon and be like, now I'm going to read, right? Because those guys are going to be like, you suck. But like, you know, you could probably go with like some, you know, I'm sure like if you went with like Joanna Newsom, it would go over really well, right? Like people would be like, I'm going to have my wine, my wine spritzer. And,
yeah. Yeah. If you could find a setup kind of like what Bobby had with
the bugs.
Huh? No, what? No. Oh shit. It was with a woman folk musician and another writer, I think. And it was, there's an album out. You can find it, I think, at the Great American Music Hall, whatever. So you like one would do a song and then Bobby would read a short piece. And then this woman would do a song again. And then the other woman would read a poem and it would just go in this round robin thing between the three of them. Let me see if I can find it here real quick.
I think I may have, if I don't have that, I have another recording of Bobby. She gave me like a double CD kind of thing.
Bobby, Rosalie Sorrells and Terry Garthwaite.
Okay.
Yeah. They're live at the Great American Music Hall thing, which came out way back. And so, yeah, Terry would read a poem. Bobby would read something. Yeah. You could do something like that. Get literature out in front of the weird places. Yeah. I like it.
Yeah. It would really depend. For me, I couldn't like do it. Like at one point I was thinking like, you know, I have some friends that are in popular bands here. And then I was like, well, could you go in front of like the Night Sweats, them, drinking and want to just dance and go, all right, now this is about, a guy who essentially has a baby that eats a squirrel and he feeds him to a coyote. Like, is that what they're going to want to listen to? No.
So you've been to AWP a few times. Have you ever met Paul Statonge? He teaches at Lewis and Carroll in, I think, Portland, Oregon.
I don't think so. I meet a lot of people there, but typically it's sort of like a whitewash of, if people give me a card or something, I'll follow up. A lot of times you'll go to one of those and you'll just get a bunch of Facebook requests and interact with those people. It's crazy. I'm exhausted when I get back from that thing.
Yeah, I've made a couple of plans to go and then had tragedies happen where I've had to withdraw my stuff. So it's I desperately want to go just so I can. My teaching opportunities dried up real quick because it took me so long to get the book published. And then after 5 years of adjuncting at a community college, when they had two full-time positions open up, I didn't even get a courtesy interview. I was like, okay, this obviously isn't going to happen. Let's because there was no way I could keep adjuncting, working full-time and trying to write and still be a human being. So I thought, well, I'll just work on the writing and I'll keep the full-time job and everything. But if you happen to get down to the next AWP, hunt down Paul Statonge. His first book was called Red Weather. His second one was Evel Knievel Days. And then he's got a kind of a memoir thing called Doggone about an experience with his wife's family's dog going missing. And he had some condition that if he didn't get his medication a certain number of hours, he was going to die. Right. And so they're all panicked trying to, that's what this book is about. It's great. But Paul's wife, Peyton Marshall, is also a writer. And her first novel came out a couple of years ago called Good House. And I would love to get the two of you talking to each other because she's our age. And in the early 90s, she was a member of a band called Third Sex out of the whole Portland, Olympia, Washington Riot Girl scene. So she's been on tour with like Sleater-Kinney and L7 and stuff like that.
I recently ran into, God, I should know her name. Like, this is how bad I am with names. I would know it on a Tuesday, right?
Right.
But she was the drummer of Spitboy, which was like sort of a California version of one of the feminist bands from the 90s. She put out a book recently, and it was at the LA AWP, and it was reading with her, Keith Morris from Circle Jerks, and Alice Bag. So it was all these old like punk people reading that from their forthcoming books. But it was just kind of funny. I was like, oh, hey, it's good to see you. You know, like, I haven't seen you since you stayed on my floor in like 1994 and 93. And we were just like talking about the show. And I was like, yeah, it's kind of crazy, right? Like, how our worlds, like, you know, all kind of, you think you're gone.
Right.
You think you're never going to see somebody again. And then Facebook comes along. Or, you know, they're in your writing world.
Yeah. Well, no.
Here we all are.
Well, I'm glad Facebook came along because it reconnected us. So
yeah, definitely. That's a
good thing. Cool. Don't go anywhere, but I'm going to sign off and stop the record here. So thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, thanks for doing this.
I'm glad to be doing it again. It's been too long. So yeah, rock on.
Yeah. All right, I'll wait here.